This is Free Speech Radio News. It's Wednesday, December 27, 2006. From KPFA in Berkeley, I'm Brian Edwards Tiekert, sitting in for Aldo Bogado. Iraq's Ba'ath Party promises attacks on U.S. targets around the world after Iraqi officials announced that the execution of Saddam Hussein is imminent. The Massachusetts Supreme Court refuses to force the state's legislature to vote on sending a proposed ban on same-sex marriage to voters. Ethiopian-backed forces advance in Somalia amidst frantic diplomatic efforts to keep the war from becoming a regional conflict. Those stories and more, but first, these headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the Free Speech Radio News headlines. A 7.1 magnitude earthquake killed two people in Taiwan yesterday. Damage to an underwater cable has affected telephone communications and internet services in Taiwan. The earthquake came 2 years to the day after a massive tsunami killed more than 200,000 people in southern Asia. A Texas suburb plans to fine landlords $500 a day for renting to undocumented immigrants. But a new lawsuit by civil rights groups may stop the plan from going into effect. Renee Feltz reports.
An ordinance barring apartment landlords from leasing to undocumented immigrants is set to go into effect in about 2 weeks in the Dallas suburb of Farmers Branch. City council members passed the measure after closed-door meetings in November and said they anticipated a lawsuit. Now they have several. This week, the American Civil Liberties Union and the Mexican-American Legal Defense Fund filed suit on behalf of landlords and residents. The suit says the ordinance is flawed because it requires landlords to enforce federal immigration law. It alleges families with legal and undocumented members would be separated, thus denying them their First Amendment right to free association. The ACLU and MALDEF argued the ordinance is poorly written, fails to provide clear guidance for landlords, allows exclusion of legal immigrants and citizens, and would mean all residents will have to carry proof of legal residency at all times. U.S. Census figures show Farmers Branch is about 37% Latino. The city established a special revenue fund to allow it to accept financial donations to help defray legal costs associated with the ordinance. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Renee Feltz.
Over the holiday recess, President Bush quietly appointed Warren Bell to the board of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Usually, the president nominates a candidate for Senate approval. However, the president can bypass Senate approval for a nominee during a recess. Therefore, Warren Bell will stay on the CPB board until the completion of a formal nomination and confirmation process or until the end of the next Senate session. Bell has worked in different capacities on a number of sitcom series, but has no experience in public broadcasting. On Saturday, the United Nations Security Council unanimously approved a resolution to impose sanctions against Iran for its nuclear enrichment program. Iran says the program is for domestic energy purposes, while the U.S. maintains that it is part of a nuclear weapons program. The Security Council had ordered Iran to stop its nuclear enrichment and ballistic missile programs in August. UK Ambassador to the UN, Jones Perry, says that the resolution sends a tough message to Iran.
Tough for a particular purpose. We're asking, requiring Iran to come into compliance with what we said earlier in the summer, and we expect Iran to do this.
Iran's parliament has started to debate its official response to the Security Council resolution. The Israeli government has approved the construction of a new Israeli settlement in the occupied West Bank to house settlers who moved out of the Gaza Strip last year. Rami Almagari reports from Gaza.
250,000 Israeli settlers currently live in 140 settlements built on illegally seized Palestinian land in the West Bank, with most of them having moved there in the last 10 years. Many of the 5,000 Israeli settlers who left in a highly publicized evacuation from three settlements in the Gaza Strip in August 2005 have been relocated to settlements in the West Bank. But most of the Israeli families who moved from Gaza have been living inside Israel, and a number of them have pressured the Israeli government to allow for the construction of a new settlement in the Jordan Valley in the eastern part of the West Bank. The settlement has already been constructed and today received approval from the Israeli government, despite a promise that the Israeli government made to the U.S. to halt construction of new settlements in the West Bank. Palestinians living in the Jordan Valley have faced increasing pressure during the settlement's construction over the last several months, including home demolitions, denial of construction permits, travel restrictions, destruction of farmlands, and Israeli army invasions into their villages and towns. for Officer Ann and IAMEMC.org. This is Rami Almirari reporting from Gaza.
And I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
After Saddam Hussein lost his last appeal yesterday, Iraq's national security minister announced that he could be executed any day over the next 4 weeks. Meanwhile, a statement released by the former ruling Ba'ath Party said its militants will target U.S. interests anywhere and everywhere if Saddam is executed. Salam Talib has the story.
An Iraqi appeal court made a decision today to execute Saddam Hussein. The White House welcomed the court ruling, but the British Home Secretary, John Reid, neither supported nor condemned the decision, and instead called the ruling an Iraqi matter.
Well, this is a sovereign decision by a sovereign nation. It is, in a sense, the ultimate expression of the sovereignty of Iraq. They are masters of their own destiny, and they have taken a decision today as controllers of that destiny, which I think all of us ought to respect.
The sentence for killing nearly 130 people in the town of Dajail in 1982. But Iraqis tell other stories that the trial didn't cover, like the story of Awatif al-Hamdani, who Saddam's regime accused of being a member of al-Dawa party. Awatif was pregnant when she was sent to prison and executed after giving birth to her daughter behind the bars in 1983. Her husband and brother were also executed. Zainab al-Hamdani, Awatif's sister.
They detained my sister and my brother. I did not get to see my brother finish medical school to become a doctor, and I did not learn anything about him until now. They executed my sister 2 months later. An officer from the secret police called the house and ordered us not to have a funeral and not to tell the neighbors that Awatif had been executed by the government. Why all of that? It is just because we did not support Saddam's regime and we are not from his tribe.
Awatif baby, Dua, was raised by her grandparents. The family decided not to tell Dua about her family history until she turned 18.
I learned later that my parents were executed and I was born in jail. When I was 18, I was shocked, and I did not accept this fact for a while. My grandparents raised me, and I became a good person, and that is my victory and my parents' victory over Saddam. That is the justice of God.
Other Iraqis think that executing Saddam will only increase the violence in the country. Nazar Samarai, an Iraqi lawyer and a political analyst.
If they are concerned about the Iraqis that Saddam killed, they should talk about the hundreds that the U.S. military and Iraqi government are killing every day. They will gain nothing from executing Saddam, and the security situation will be worse because of the people who supported Saddam. The Americans are making a big mistake if they allow Saddam to be executed.
For Free Speech Radio News, I am Salam Talib.
Meanwhile, U.S. casualties continue to mount in Iraq. The military announced three more deaths today, bringing the U.S. death toll to 2,983 since the beginning of the invasion. That number is now higher than the number of civilians who died in the September 11th attacks on the United States. President Bush says he is considering several proposals for new strategies in Iraq, including sending more troops to the battleground. That plan is sparking controversy in the nation's capital, Yan Meishi reports.
The so-called troop surge proposal would add as many as 30,000 U.S. soldiers to Iraq. Many believe President Bush is likely to adopt this plan, but he says it's just one suggestion among many that he's studying.
I will tell you we're looking at all options. And one of those options, of course, is increasing more troops. But in order to do so, there must be a specific mission that can be accomplished with more troops. And that's precisely what our commanders have said, as well as people who know a lot about military operations, and I agree with them.
Some key Republicans, including Senator John McCain, a potential presidential candidate, and Senator Lindsey Graham, have spoken in favor of increasing troop levels. Even influential Democrats, such as the incoming Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid and Hillary Clinton, another likely presidential contender, have said they would support a troop surge if it's part of a plan to bring Americans home by the end of next year. However, Democrat Joseph Biden, the incoming chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, sees minimal merit in a troop increase.
It is quite clear to me that a surging of up to 30,000 American troops will not have any positive effect except extremely temporarily.
In the eyes of those more cynical to the plan, not even temporary benefit is possible. Lawrence Korb served as Assistant Defense Secretary under President Jimmy Carter.
It would increase the Iraqi dependence on the United States, and the only leverage we have left with the Iraqis to get them to make the painful political compromises necessary to begin the reconciliation process is our troop levels. If you send more troops, as people have urged, in fact, you would really reinforce the occupation mentality and take away any incentives that they have to do what they need to do.
Senator Biden says he has scheduled 3 hearings next month to evaluate the proposal, but he admits the hearings can have limited influence on the president.
I am not so optimistic he'll take it from the hearings, but I suspect if we can, out of those hearings, generate some bipartisan consensus in the Senate, then he may very well listen to some of my Republican colleagues.
Democratic leaders in Congress have said they would guarantee funding for the 140,000 U.S. service members currently in Iraq. Lawrence Korb suggests Democrats to place a valve on funding for additional troops.
We say in there that the president, if he wants to go above 150,000, so we're giving him a 10,000 buffer now, has to come back to the Congress with a plan that says how they would be used, what would be the purpose, what's the long-range goal, and then Congress would vote up or down on it.
Former Secretary of State Colin Powell has warned that more troops are not feasible because the U.S. military force is already stretched very thin. President Bush says he's aware of the concern.
I'm inclined to believe that we need to increase in the permanent size of both the United States Army and the United States Marines. I've asked Secretary Gates to determine how such an increase could take place and report back to me as quickly as possible.
However, some military experts estimate that recruiting and training fresh members for combats takes a year or so, not in time for the current crisis in Iraq. Bush will host a National Security Council meeting tomorrow at his Texas ranch to discuss Iraqi policy options. Vice President Cheney, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, and Defense Secretary Robert Gates will attend the meeting. For Free Speech Radio News, Ye Meixie in Washington, D.C.
The latest reports from Somalia indicate Ethiopian-backed forces have captured the town of Jowhar, about 55 miles from the nation's capital. As fighting enters its 10th day, there are frantic diplomatic efforts underway in Africa and the United Nations. The Security Council is holding a discussion to come up with a way to end the conflict in Somalia. It has the potential to grow into a regional war in the Horn of Africa. Abdurrahman Warsama has more from Mogadishu.
Ethiopia's Russian-made MiG fighter jets bombed many locations in the south and center of Somalia, including Mogadishu International Airport and Beledweyne Military Airfield, 15 kilometers south of the Somali capital, Mogadishu. No major damage was caused by the raids, but one woman was slightly injured at Mogadishu Airport. Shortly after the air strikes, a private plane carrying Sheikh Hassan Dair Awais, the leader of the Shura Council of the Islamic Courts, and Sheikh Sharif Sheikh Ahmed, the chairman of the executive committee of the CIC, landed at Mogadishu Airport. It is not clear whether they were the intended target. In his first news conference after the start of the conflict and hours after the raids on the airports, Sheikh Sharif Sheikh Ahmed accused the Ethiopian troops of resorting to air power after they met stiff resistance.
We are very surprised, and the world is silent about it, that a man in Addis Ababa says, "I fear for my security, so I should attack Mogadishu." That is really shocking. It is really shocking that the Mogadishu airport is bombed, the seaport is bombed. That means they were closed because of them, and the men here were their proxies. If the proxy is removed, they are going to come here.
Since fighting broke out, the Islamic group has used every means they can to rally support, including asking radio stations in places they control to play patriotic songs about the 1977 war between Somalia and Ethiopia. Dr. Mohamed Deq, a political analyst in the Somali capital, believes regarding the swiftness with which they are retreating, the days of the Islamists in Somalia are numbered.
We've never seen an invasion into Somalia with such depth for generations and coming so close to the capital. The huge loss that these so-called Islamists faced at the front lines may result in their use of civilians in the capital as human shields. To me, that will cause a humanitarian catastrophe. They'll seek places to hide, but that seems futile. As you can see, they are contained in Mogadishu, with government forces coming from the south and the north of the capital. The bottom line now is how to save the city from meaningless conflict. I think this marks the end of the small drama by the Islamists, and we should all start rebuilding the country and stop the weekly revolutions that do not add to the reconstruction of the country. I think things could be bad at first, but at the end of the day, we should all pave the way for the government to spread its authority in the capital.
Shortly after the press conference, it was reported that more towns in the south and center of the country fell to the advancing government forces backed by the Ethiopians. Then hours later, in a hastily arranged news conference, the executive chairman of the CIC said that the Ethiopian troops committed massacres and called the Somali people to join the courts. The raids and the possible onslaught on the capital worries the more than 2 million residents of Mogadishu who have endured 16 years of conflict like others in the country. People have started stockpiling foodstuffs in case the war for the control of the capital drags on for a long time. Hawa Ilmi, a mother of four, thinks there are tough times ahead for Mogadishites.
If the Ethiopian troops encircle the town, I am afraid we shall have a difficult time ahead of us. I have small kids. They are really scared. They don't understand what is going on. The bigger ones dream about the raids. They sometimes shout at night from their sleep. Those people do not care about us. I think the fighting in the capital may drag on for a long time, Allah knows how long, but I fear the food we stored may not last us that long. The UN just talks and talks, they do nothing really useful. Only Allah can help us.
As things stand, there seems to be a quick end to major war, but if the Islamists fulfill what they promised and wage a long guerrilla war, then the nightmare for the people of Somalia looks not over yet. Reporting for FSRN, this is Abdurrahman Warsame in Mogadishu.
Sri Lankan military officials said today that five people were killed in clashes between government forces and Tamil Tiger rebels in the war-torn northeastern region. On Christmas Day, at least nine combatants were killed and nine wounded, in spite of religious leaders' call for a cessation of hostilities. Thousands of civilians have fled their homes because of the escalating violence. Panaya Manikavasagam reports from Sri Lanka.
As the Sri Lankan peace process has almost come to a standstill, officials said more than 30,000 civilians from the rebel-held region have sought refuge in the government-controlled district of Batticolo. Rain and floods are tempering the relief measures and aid workers are facing difficulties. Displaced people say they are forced to use the jungle paths and boats to reach the army-controlled area. The government says it has closed the key highway connecting the rebel-held territory with the army-controlled areas for security reasons. It blames the rebels are making use of that road to launch attacks on Sri Lankan troops. The rebels deny the charge and counter that the government is continuing attacks. Parameswari Mohan is a mother of two children. She is from a farming family in Vahare. She had fled her village to escape the continuing artillery shells fired from the army-controlled areas. Her family and many others had taken the jungle paths to reach Batticolo.
We had no food. We were walking through the jungles for 3 days to come here. We've lost our jewelry, clothes, and other valuables. We are hungry, and we have nothing except the clothes we are wearing.
The army has made transport arrangements for the refugees reaching its border to be immediately taken to transit camps set up in the suburbs of Batticolo. Displaced families are later transferred to arranged welfare centers from here. Nahalingam Periyasami and his neighbors took the sea route to reach Batticolo. Before boarding a bus near Valachennai, he said that boat journey was a nightmare to him.
We came by boat. We saw the boat ahead of us turning over. We couldn't do anything to help. Our boat also sank in the water, and we were lucky to escape. We were fully soaked and lost our bags. We have nothing. We have lost everything.
David Vignetti is the information officer of the International Committee of Red Cross. He says immediate assistance is provided to the refugees by government and humanitarian officials.
We are distributing construction material to build more stable shelters. We also focus our intervention on the hygienic and sanitary conditions, attain drinking water distribution. In addition to that, we collaborate with the Sri Lanka Red Cross Society to assist these people to find their families in case they lost the link with their families. So we are registering also these people.
Government officials in Batticolo said a number of welfare centers have been established to house the displaced people. School buildings are also being used for this purpose. Education officials say that they are anticipating a delay in reopening the schools for the new term in a few days as alternative shelters are not available for the people housed in school buildings. Health department officials say that an epidemic of a viral fever, chikungunya, in the district is on the rise, and the preventive measures in the welfare centers is very difficult as they are congested. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Ponneya Manikavasagam from Vavuniya, Sri Lanka.
This morning, Massachusetts' highest court said it will not require the legislature to vote on putting a constitutional referendum to ban gay marriage on the state ballot. Same-sex marriage has been legal in Massachusetts since a court ruling in 2003. Conservative groups submitted a 170,000-signature petition asking to revise the state constitution by ballot initiative in order to ban same-sex marriage. But that initiative requires a vote of the state legislature to actually get on the ballot. State lawmakers used a procedural tactic to virtually guarantee that the issue will not go to a vote this year. That prompted a lawsuit spearheaded by Governor Mitt Romney, who's expected to seek the Republican nomination for president in 2008. The state's judicial court ruled that the legislature does have a constitutional duty to vote on putting the issue on the ballot, but it also said the court can't force lawmakers to do their job. Norma Shapiro, chief lobbyist for the American Civil Liberties Union in Massachusetts, says there's little popular pressure on lawmakers to take on the issue.
Those of us who support same-sex marriage have been looking at the polls. The polls are favorable in Massachusetts. Only 6% of the voters consider it an important issue. They are much more concerned about funding education, about health care, about a wide variety of issues that affect everybody in the Commonwealth. So I don't know that we're worried. I think that we would like to see the legislature, however, do the right thing here. The right thing is not to take the rights of a minority and put them up to a vote of the majority. We don't want discrimination in our Constitution.
However, conservative groups are far from conceding defeat in the only state to formally legalize same-sex marriage. I'm joined by Lisa Barstow, a spokesperson for the Massachusetts Family Institute. Lisa Barstow, isn't this ruling a setback?
Not at all. What the SJC did was make it crystal clear that lawmakers in Massachusetts have a constitutional obligation to vote on the marriage amendment.
And yet the court put no teeth in it. They said they can't force legislators to vote on the measure. Where does that leave you?
Well, essentially, we recognize that there is a separation of powers and that we would not expect that they could compel the legislature to vote. But what they have done is made it clear that there are no more excuses for legislators to hide behind.
Opponents of the measure argue for the principle that a majority of the electorate should not be able to vote to suppress the rights of a minority. Do they have a point there?
Well, look, they can argue that, but what we are looking for, frankly, is the citizen initiative process to go forward unimpeded. And again, that's what the SJC has distinguished today, that lawmakers have a constitutional duty to vote, and we expect that they will.
Would the same principle apply to a constitutional ban on marriage between black people and white people?
We're not debating those issues, and those are all issues worthy of public debate. But if you shut down the citizen initiative process, according to our Constitution, then you have violated the civil rights and First Amendment rights of all citizens of the Commonwealth. So, frankly, we have to ensure that the Constitution works for everyone, and we have to ensure that the citizen initiative process remains intact and viable in Massachusetts for everyone's sake.
Lisa Barstow, thank you for joining us on Free Speech Radio News.
You're welcome.
Lisa Barstow is a spokesperson for the Massachusetts Family Institute, which is campaigning for a constitutional ban on same-sex marriage in Massachusetts. Former President Gerald Ford died last night at the age of 93. Darby Hickey has more from the nation's capital.
From pardoning President Richard Nixon to offering limited amnesty to Vietnam-era draft dodgers, Gerald Ford Jr., born Leslie Lynch King Jr., made controversial decisions at a turning point in U.S. history as he sought to heal a nation that he saw in crisis. After a childhood in the Midwest and years as a football player and then Navy officer, Ford first entered politics in 1948. He was elected to the House of Representatives and served for 12 terms before being appointed to fill the vacancy left by Vice President Spiro Agnew, who resigned amid tax evasion charges in late 1973. Less than a year later, Ford would ascend to the highest executive office in the country, replacing President Nixon in August 1974.
I believe that truth is the glue that holds government together. Not only our government, but civilization itself. That bond, though stained, is unbroken at home and abroad. In all my public and private acts as your president, I expect to follow my instincts of openness and candor with full confidence that honesty is always the best policy in the end.
After initial public approval ratings of over 70%, Ford's popularity plummeted when he pardoned Nixon in September 1974. He closed the book on U.S. military involvement in Vietnam by refusing to bolster the South Vietnam government when Northern forces overran it in April 1975. His proposal for a conditional amnesty of draft dodgers was also criticized. At a time when inflation and energy prices were trashing the U.S. economy, Ford didn't mince words about the country's situation in his State of the Union address of 1975.
The State of the Union is not good. Millions of Americans are out of work. Recession and inflation are eroding the money of millions more. Prices are too high and sales are too slow. This year's federal deficit will be about $30 billion. Next year's probably $45 billion. The national debt will rise to over $500 billion.
Most of President Ford's proposals to address the recession got little traction with a Democrat-led Congress. Despite extremely low poll ratings going into the presidential election of 1976, Ford beat off a primary challenge from then-Governor Ronald Reagan and made a good showing against Democratic candidate Jimmy Carter, but lost by 2 percentage points of the popular vote. The cause of death of Gerald R. Ford, Jr., the 38th President of the United States, is not yet known. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Darby Hickey in Washington, D.C. I got soul,
and I'm super bad. Finally, music legend James Brown's career will come full circle tomorrow. Friends of Brown announced that his body will be brought to rest on the stage of the legendary Apollo Theater in Harlem, where Brown made his explosive career debut. The public will be permitted to visit the Apollo to have one more look at Brown on Thursday. The viewing will be followed by a private ceremony in Brown's hometown of Augusta, Georgia, and on Friday, another public ceremony in Augusta at the James Brown Arena. Hey! I said I'm super bad. Red! You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. I'm Brian Edwards-Tiekert, sitting in for Outta Bogato.